Hello and welcome to Map Bites episode 34. I'm Elaine Giles and I'm here with my co-host Mike Thomas. And in this episode, we discuss how to speed up your podcasts, manage your default apps, and how to quick look zip files. But first, we've been away and we've got 2 weeks to catch up on.
We certainly have. And Bento 3 snuck up on us, didn't it? And I think there was some confusion with that.
Yes, Bento 3, the launch that never was. It was very strange. I noticed it just appeared on Mac Update with no mention from FileMaker, but it was the real deal, and it took 24 hours for the marketing department to catch up with the engineering department. And yes, it was real and all was well. Previously, I didn't upgrade from Bento 1 to Bento 2. I did buy Bento 1 and I did use it, but the upgrade policy struck me as a little harsh. There was no upgrade pricing. And you could say, well, that's only what Apple do with iLife and iWork. But the difference with Bento was, one, there's only one application rather than a whole suite of them for a similar price. But there was only 8 months between the release of Bento 1 and the appearance of version 2, which I thought was a bit quick. And it also wasn't, there wasn't really enough additional features to make the whole thing a full point upgrade to me. What did happen was it got very annoying when I elected not to upgrade to version 2 when the iPhone integration was added, because it was only added to version 2. But by then, I'd waited long enough thinking I was going to wait for version 3 that I wasn't going to be persuaded to buy version 2. But it seems they've learnt their lesson, and there is now an upgrade path for $20 or £10 rebate for previous owners. And it's not just version 2, it's also version 1. So I will buy version 3, just for the iPhone syncing, if nothing else.
Yeah, I've never actually used Bento. I've built plenty of databases over the years using stuff like Access, SQL, and even DataEase and DBase, if you want to go back that far. But they were all in a corporate environment or for websites that we run, and I can't really think of many uses for a database at home that a spreadsheet couldn't satisfy.
True. For me, the ability to transfer to the iPhone in a format that you can actually see without pinching the zoom to death in a spreadsheet is probably going to be the deciding factor.
Yeah, that's probably the killer feature for me that will probably tip me towards it.
Well, that one thing I did notice was it got its usual positive review in Macworld. They have given Bento a positive review every time. Now, version 1 was something new in terms of it was at least a commercial database for the Mac that was affordable. FileMaker's very nice, but very expensive. So I could see a positive review for that. But when version 2 came out, they didn't really mention the negatives, which were the lack of features to the update, the price of the update, and the fact there was no update path, and how quickly it came. They didn't really mention that. So I had a read of the review, and it's extremely positive, to the extent I'm wondering if Macworld have got shares in FileMaker.
You've got to wonder, haven't you, really?
You do. It was that positive.
Yeah. Well, another nice update that came out this week was ITV 3.2 and the ITV iPhone app, which lets you stream your ITV to your phone. It's a pity it needs Wi-Fi, as otherwise I could spend my lunchtime watching Neighbours and Jeremy Kyle.
Actually, it doesn't need Wi-Fi. It needs Wi-Fi for live TV, but you can watch recordings as long as you prepare them correctly, which you can have it do automatically, and they will transfer over the cellular network. And I've tried it. The picture is obviously much, much better on Wi-Fi, but I did actually manage on 3G to stream a 3 gig file, and it looked all right. It wasn't too bad.
Great, so I could record Neighbours and Jeremy Kyle and watch them the next day?
Yes, if you really wanted to.
No, it's just an example. Not my telly-watching programmes. Basically, as you say, it serves as a mobile extension to the Elgato desktop ITV app. So it lets you watch live TV, lets you do things like change channels, watch your recordings, browse a programme guide, start your recordings back home on your Mac or schedule them later, and also view and edit recording schedules. You will need the ITV 3.2 installed on a Mac, and you'll need a compatible TV tuner connected to it as well.
Well, one thing I have actually done, I have used the remote scheduling. I have been around the house, so not actually sat with my computer. Yes, it does actually happen. Sometimes I'm not sat in front of it. And I have been able to schedule programmes to record. So that has proved very useful. And you can do that, of course, remotely as well over the 3G network.
Sounds great. So I could be out walking the dog and schedule neighbours, Jeremy Kyle.
I'm getting very worried about your TV watching.
So am I, but what I actually did is I went onto the programme guide and I just saw what was on at lunchtime because, you know, lunchtime's my own. I can't be saying that I'm watching TV during working hours.
I don't want you watching. Maybe best avoided, I think.
Anyway, on a related note, you actually got an email to remind you to renew your TV account, didn't you, which came in German?
I did. It is a German company, but I'm convinced in the past I have had emails in both languages, but this one was solely in German. I didn't get another email in English, so I thought, well, OK, I've got the gist of it. I'd forgotten it was due, but I think it must be due. So I went to Babelfish, which did come to the rescue. It was pretty accurate. So I clicked the link in it, which was to a store. I could see that much from the link, and that was German as well. Completely German. So I wasn't doing too well at all there, even though my profile's in English, and I couldn't find a link to the English site from the site that they'd sent me to. So I did have to play around a bit, and in the end I did find a link to it. But I decided I would wait until the actual day that it was due to renew it, because there just wasn't enough information about whether it would go from the day you paid and not the day that you renewed. I think it'd be nice if they notice that your profile is said, you know, English, that they actually sent you an email in English. That would be most helpful.
That would be good, but, you know, good practice for you, German.
I don't speak a word of German, sadly. If it was in French, I might have stood a little bit of a chance, but the German, I just looked at and thought, Babelfish. So luckily it wasn't too bad. Usually you do get something that it doesn't resemble an email at all, but it was close enough that I got the gist of what it needed. So I was able to sort that out, but I think that's pretty bad form myself. And another thing that appeared on the iPhone after what seemed like an eternity waiting was Dropbox. And I'm certainly using Dropbox more than ever, mainly with a lot of shared application settings. And I did try it with the phone and I was very impressed with the speed of it.
Yeah, I've been using Dropbox a lot more too, mainly for transferring files between home and work. And it also means that I can view and show presentations on the phone. If I stick them up in my Dropbox, I can actually display them live on the phone. What I do like is that favourites feature, which will download it onto your phone. And that way, where I don't have a signal, and there are places at work where I don't have a signal, I can still view my content.
No, I've not had to do that because I'm usually in Wi-Fi range. But I think I'm going to probably upgrade to a 50 gig account, maybe even 100, splash some money around.
Yeah, we're actually relying more and more on our phones, aren't we? Not particularly as a phone for the functionality, but the what the apps give us. But one story this week, it looks like some developers are taking advantage with an iPhone loophole. And the story goes that apparently a few days after purchasing the Swiss app, which is called Mogo Road, which is a free radar tracking application, users are reporting receiving telephone calls asking them if they'd like to purchase the full version of the application. Now, when asked how the caller had obtained their number, the responses varied, but generally the person tells you that Apple sent their number to them at the time of purchase. Now, obviously, this is not the case, as Apple don't forward any information on its customers to third parties. But Mac Forever, which is the site that reported this, did a little bit of testing using the latest iPhone SDK and discovered that it's extremely easy for a developer to send a user's phone number to their servers without their knowledge. In fact, the hole has actually been around since the 2.1 firmware update.
That, I think, is diabolical. And if they ever ring me, they're going to get an earful, just like Vodafone did.
Yeah, but you used to have the perfect get out of jail free card with Vodafone because they didn't have an iPhone.
I know. I'm going to have to tell them that I'm using a Zune and I don't want to switch.
What, so you'd admit to using a Zune? You'll be admitting to using Windows next.
No. I don't use a Zune. They don't even sell them here, do they? Talking of which, globalisation. Even Amazon are realising that there is life beyond the US because they are now allowing the import of Kindles. But...
I knew there'd be a but.
Ah, yes, but not at Adobe. Twitter was alive with all my user group manager contacts. I'm an Adobe user group manager. And all my contacts from Adobe were announcing the proud arrival of new baby Photoshop.com app for the iPhone. Oh, I thought, cool. Yeah, I've got an account, got pictures up there. So I click the link, and what do I get? A curt message telling me it's not available in the UK. So really, just one response to that. Why not? Now, I know there is a geographic limitation on Photoshop.com or Photoshop Express, as it used to be known when it was launched. And to be honest, that's also not cool. So there is a link where you can go and see a website, which is mobile.photoshop.com/iPhone. And there's a pretty picture of an iPhone. And on said iPhone, there's a pretty picture of the app. And that's as far as you get.
Yeah, it's a bizarre decision, isn't it, on their part?
It is. And while I'm at it, the use of a flash sign-in box on Photoshop.com is even worse because it doesn't work with 1Password. So major fail all round there, I think.
Yeah, big failure. Anyway, in the last episode, we were discussing iTunes, and something that I've been looking at is how to play podcasts at different speeds. Now, you may be wondering why. Well, I subscribe to quite a few podcasts and my listening time is limited. So I've found that the double speed option on the iPhone is great. And I actually find that most podcasts can be played at double speed without what I call the pinky and perky or helium effect. If you don't know what I'm talking about, when you listen to something at double speed, it usually sounds like somebody has got helium coming out of their mouth and it's really high pitched, but it doesn't actually happen that way. So you can still actually understand what's being said. Sometimes I listen to podcasts at home, and I tend to use iTunes to do so. I don't know why; it just seems logical to me to use the phone when I'm out and the iMac when I'm at home. So I was thinking it would be good if iTunes had the same functionality as the phone, but of course it doesn't. And it seems that I'm not the only one who wants this functionality, according to the forums and the websites that I've been reading. Anyway, I did find a script that picks up the currently playing podcast, picks up the current position in terms of time, opens QuickTime Player, and plays it in that using double speed. And by editing one element of the script, you can actually change the speed. So, for example, you could have it at 1.5 speed. Now, I'll put the link to that on the show notes. But what I did is I copied the script into the Apple script editor and saved it to my library iTunes scripts folder inside my home folder, which is where my other iTunes scripts are. But when I tried to run the script, I got an error which said expected class name but found identifier. Now, not being an Apple programmer, couldn't really do much about that, but further investigation actually revealed that several people have been unable to use this script with Snow Leopard. However, I have found a couple of solutions. The first one's a bit convoluted, and what you do is you right-click on the podcast in iTunes and select Show in Finder. Then when the Finder opens, right-click on the file and select Open with QuickTime Player 7. Now, that assumes that you have got QuickTime Player 7 installed. In QuickTime, if you select Window, Show AV Controls, what that does, it displays the AV Controls palette. And on this palette, there is a playback speed slider control, so you can select to play the podcast at anywhere from half speed to triple speed.
You do realise, don't you, that by the time you've done all that, I've listened to the podcast at normal speed and I'm on to the next one.
You know, I knew you'd say something like that.
Carry on.
You always like to rain on my parade, don't you?
If it makes you happy.
Well, in addition to podcasts, the playback speed slider also works for normal music and videos as well. So if you want to listen to... the Gumbay Dance Band at triple speed, then you could do.
Oh my God. You'll be frightening the listeners. And you do realise anybody who's listening at this podcast at double speed will have just got that at 6 times speed.
Mm.
That'll stop them doing that, won't it?
Now, if you're using Snow Leopard and you didn't install QuickTime 7, be aware that in QuickTime 10, notice I'm calling it QuickTime 10, not QuickTime X.
I am.
The AV control palette isn't actually there. However, if you click the fast forward button once, the speed changes to 2 speed. Click it again, you get 4 speed, and click it again, you get 8 speed. And doing the same with the rewind button plays the track in reverse at the appropriate speed. Reminds me of one of those cryptic messages they used to put in Prince records.
Yeah, can you play them backwards as well?
Yes, you can actually.
By using
the rewind button, it plays it backwards. If you want to play it at normal speed, you just click the play button. Anyway, whilst this works, it's obviously not as flexible as the options that you get in that AV control panel in Leopard. But if you hold the option key down before clicking either the fast forward or rewind button, the first speed you'll get will be 1.1, and then each subsequent click will increase the rate by 1.1 up to a maximum of 8 speed.
I've lost the will to live.
The only downside is that whereas you can actually look at that slider control and see the current setting, with QuickTime 10 there's actually no visual indication of the current speed. Now, the second solution is a script from Doug's Scripts, which is Snow Leopard compatible, but I didn't find this until after I found that first solution, and that first solution seems much more fun to try anyway.
You've got too much time on your hands.
No, it's all research for the show. Good way to while away a Sunday afternoon, isn't it? This script simply opens up the single selected audio or video track in iTunes using QuickTime Player and opens the AV controls so that you can then select the required speed. I'll stick a link to the script in the show notes for anyone who might be interested.
Cool. And while you've been rabbiting on, listen to what I've made.
Oh no, I've made a monster, haven't I?
Afraid so. You shouldn't tempt me with these things, you see. I'd have been completely oblivious. Anyway, I've had my own problems. Snow Leopard's been driving me mad this week.
Yeah, from the mutterings I've been hearing, Snow Leopard's been driving you mad for about 5 weeks, hasn't it? So, is this Snow Leopard in general or something specific?
Well, it's specifically how it's deciding which applications to use to open my files.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo?
That's about right, I reckon. No, seriously, I know they've changed the rules, but even knowing what the new rules are, it's still very inconsistent. Previously, it used an application-specific code, called a creator code, to bind a file to the application that created it. And I found that worked very, very well. It was quite flexible. So you could have the same file types opening in different applications depending which application you'd use to create it. And like I say, it used a creator code to achieve that magic. And to me, coming from Windows, I did find that magic. It meant that I could have some JPEGs open with Preview, others open with Photoshop, others open with Fireworks. It was great. Now, obviously on Windows, that was one size fits all, and the file extension trumped everything else. So it depended on the file extension, and you could change what handled a file extension, but it was all or nothing. And switchers and anybody who wanted to have that Windows way implemented on their Mac, well, you could still assign a file extension to a specific app if you wanted to. But the problem in a nutshell is now... an application running under Snow Leopard cannot use a creator code to bind a document to itself. So, for instance, I use several different text editors.
Yeah, as many text editors as you have browsers.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but it's horses for courses depending on what I'm doing. So with BB Edit, I've got lots of panels and palettes and all sorts open all over the place. I usually have files open as well, and a lot of the time they are I'm opening them from FTP. So when I open BB Edit, it can take a few seconds while it sets everything up. So if I just want to edit a quick text file, I might use TextMate or even TextEdit. And previously, each file that I opened would know which application had made it, and that's the application it would have used to open it. But what's happening now is, irrespective of which text editor I use to make my text file, when I double-click on them, they are all being opened by TextEdit.
Yeah, now you mention it, I've had problems with like that, but I've not worked out why.
Well, that's the thing. I've rebuilt so many machines with Snow Leopard and reinstalled so much software in the last 5 weeks that I really hadn't thought about it too much, and I've still got more to go. So I wasn't actually taking that much notice, because what I was thinking is, well, you've not finished completely configuring these machines yet, so maybe you'd done something. They're not back to how I had them before, because I did a scorched earth on every one. But no, it's not me. It's a change that Apple have made. So for me, text files are my main issue, but graphics such as JPEGs are a problem too, and PNGs are even worse.
Why? What's the problem with PNGs?
Well, PNGs are not all equal. While they are a good file format to use because you get high quality and low file size, yeah, it also supports transparency, which of course JPEGs don't. There are also very specific derivatives of the PNG file format, which are very different in function. So, for instance, Adobe Fireworks uses the PNG file format for its native file format, and it extends the basic purpose to allow Photoshop to save within a PNG file layers, effects, vectors, masks, even up to multiple pages. And it saves all of those things in a PNG file. So what I've found is that all the files I create in Fireworks, when I double-click them, previously they would open in Fireworks, it would know the difference. Now they're all opening in Preview. And all Preview gives me is a preview of the file. It gives me no indication of all the contents, it's just a flattened preview of it.
So what options have you got to fix it?
There isn't a perfect one, to be honest. You've got a few. You can go to the Get Info dialog, so Command and I on a file, and you can, in that dialog, assign a handler on a file-by-file basis. But that would mean every time I created a file, obviously I don't want to allocate all my PNGs to Fireworks, because Fireworks crashes regularly when I try and close it. But if I created the file in there, then I want it to open in there. So what I'd have to do is use the Get Info dialog and allocate Fireworks to open it on a file-by-file basis, which is just going to slow me down immensely. The second thing I could do is, assuming that I've navigated my way to the file, I could use a launcher to launch that file in a specific application. So, for example, I could get LaunchBar to grab the file and then select the app to open it with. Or I could right-click and select Open With. Hopefully that what I want to open it with is available from that first set of options. If not, then I'm going to have to choose Other, and then I'm going to have to go and find the application. Again, slows you down greatly. Another thing I could do is I could add application icons to the Finder window and drag and drop the files to whichever application I wanted. And in a similar principle, you could have all the applications in your dock, and you could drag and drop the icons to the dock.
Yeah, the first option that you mentioned does slow you down. I know I've tried it, but I don't know how to get LaunchBar to do that. You mentioned LaunchBar.
Yeah, what you do is you locate the file to be opened, click on it to select it. Then you use your selected shortcut key. So for most people, it's Command and Spacebar. You hold that for fractionally longer than normal. And what happens is it transfers the file to LaunchBar. If you then press Tab, it tabs across and it gives you a list of applications. Now, it is all your applications, so you're going to have to scroll up or down or start typing the name of the required app. And once you've got the required app selected, you just press Enter to open it.
Cool. The drag and drop to a dock icon I've done, often with Pixelmator, where the app's already running and I don't want to use File Open, but I've got a Finder window on screen. Because the app's all over the screen, you've got lots of palettes, haven't you, rather than one single window. You can't just drop the file into the app, so I have been dropping files onto the dock icon. But I've also had problems with a right click on things like RAF files, which are Fuji RAW for my camera. When I right click, it offers me Photoshop, Pixelmator, Preview and Sketch. But out of those, only Photoshop actually recognises that particular file type. The others give an error saying unrecognised format. So you'd at least think it would be clever enough to know what it can and can't open it with.
Yeah, the right click and open with should be the fastest way to handle the issue. But you know the trouble we've had. As you say, the apps listed often won't open the file. you've got other apps that will, but they're only available via other, and it takes an age to load. And more applications you've got, the slower it works. And the right-click menu is just not as user-configurable as it is in Windows. You'll find old applications listed, applications you've uninstalled will still be listed, multiple copies of the same application. And my personal pet peeve is applications that are on other drives.
Yeah, I right-clicked on an AVI file and it offered me QuickTime Player and VLC, which is fine, but also Pixelmator, and I did actually, just to test it, try opening it with Pixelmator, and five copies of Windows Media Player, which I'm guessing must be one from each virtual machine that I've got.
Oh yes, I'd forgotten the joy of the Windows apps from the VM being listed as well. That was one of my main reasons for making the decision not to reinstall either Fusion or Parallels. I just couldn't cope with all the rubbish it put in there.
Yeah, there is a way to clean up that right-click menu though, isn't there?
Yeah, we've talked about it before, but that was on Tiger and Leopard, and I've found that my old tricks aren't working too well, so I've had to change how I do it. It's a two-step process. You've got to tidy up the menu first, so tidy up the mess, and then the second thing is you've got to keep it tidy somehow, because you've got so little control over it that it will automatically start to repopulate the thing. Now, what I used to do under Tiger and Leopard was there was a terminal command. So it was just a single line terminal command. Open the terminal, paste it in, press enter and you're done. I could not get that to work under Snow Leopard. Now, there used to be two different versions, one for Tiger and one for Leopard. So I'm assuming that the one for Leopard doesn't work under Snow Leopard. I tried a few options. You know, we've talked about Tinker Tool, Onyx, Main Menu. None of those worked for me either. Now, this was pretty soon after I'd installed Snow Leopard, so maybe they've been updated. But the one that I found that did work was Cocktail. And the option that you need is an option to rebuild the Launch Services database. Now, that will sort it out at that point. But like I said, what will then happen is it will start looking around and any applications it finds, it has the habit of adding them back. So what I did then was I used the excellent Spotless from Fixamac software. And what you can do in that is actually turn the indexing off. Now, what I do is I turn the indexing off on my super duper drives. So I actually have two drives attached to my main machine. One has an image of Leopard on it, my old Leopard image, and the other has a continually updated super duper image of my current system. So that gets updated every day. So, of course, all the applications that are on my main system are replicated on both of those drives, really. So when you look at my right click, it can look horrendous. But what Spotless allows you to do is delete the index from those drives and turn the indexing off, so it doesn't get recreated and hence they don't get added straight back. Because that's what would happen. All the applications it could find would be added straight back into the Launch Services and you'd be back where you started. But it's long-winded.
Yeah, I don't think any of these solutions are perfect, are they?
No, because they're all either slower than how it worked previously, or they require a lot of configuration. You can't really have every app on your dock or every app in a toolbar on the Finder window. If you've got more than a couple of file types that are causing you the problems, then those methods just won't work. If you're not careful when you're rebuilding Launch Services as well, you might reset all the manual file associations. So you can, as we've said, right-click, get your info up and in there manually assign a file type to an application or one particular file to an application. But in the Launch Services rebuild, there is a checkbox. Now, luckily, it's not checked by default, but if you're not sure what you're doing, you think, well, I'll just check everything. What that will do is it will wipe out all the manual associations that you've painstakingly created. So I didn't think that was overly good either. I just wish they'd return it to the way that it was handled before.
Yeah, but that wasn't without its issues. Sometimes I'd double-click a JPEG and it'd open in preview, and sometimes Photoshop. At which point I'll either go and make a cup of tea or I'd bum out of it because I don't really need the £800 Photoshop Gorilla opening just to view a JPEG.
True, there's no pleasing all the people all the time. It's somewhat reminiscent of the tabs at the top or the tabs at the bottom debate with Safari.
Let's not go there.
No, we best not. We'll only upset Gaz.
Yeah, I've got a similar issue in a related area. I have some HTML files, HTML files, and I want to be able to look at them using Quick Look. Now, when I use Quick Look, when I just highlight a file in Finder and hit the spacebar, what I actually see is the output. In other words, what you'd see in a browser, where I actually want to see the raw HTML code. Now, I checked the get info on the file and I found that Safari was set as the default handler. And I thought that maybe that was the problem. So I changed it to BBEdit, tested it by double clicking, and yeah, it opens up in BBEdit, but Quick Look still gives me the output and not the raw HTML. However, Quick Look does work the way I want with PHP files, but with .asp files, it doesn't work at all. All I see is when I hit the spacebar, I just see like an icon that says ASP and I can't see the content at all.
Now, I've had a similar thing with ASP files. And another file type that I use for web development, which is ink files. And initially the ASP files were allocated to Dreamweaver and I just got the icon you're talking about. But then I set them elsewhere and I still had just an icon, but then it wasn't a Dreamweaver icon, it was a plain icon. And then I noticed on certain ASP files I was getting a preview. And on other ASP files I was not only getting a preview, I was getting a coloured preview. So it's just not consistent at all. And it is amazing just how quickly I've come to rely on Quick Look. I certainly notice it's missing when I'm on a Tiger machine or a Windows machine. And I automatically just try and use it. So
yeah, many times I've hit the spacebar on Windows and then wonder why it's not displayed a preview.
Sometimes it actually tries to rename the file as well, so not great.
It does. Anyway, talking of Quick Look, I was reading this week about X-ray mode, which is a hidden feature that's not enabled by default and which can actually only be enabled through the terminal. Now, essentially, when X-ray mode is turned on, instead of seeing the regular folder icon in Quick Look, so this is Quick Look on a folder rather than a file, the folder icon will be semi-transparent with previews of the folder's contents visible inside the Quick Look window. The preview images will rotate automatically through each item in the folder. So if you've got, for example, a folder of 20 JPEGs, then what you'll see is you'll see the blue folder icon, but just behind it, you will see little icons that represent each image, and it will automatically flip each one to the front. And you can, if you look closely enough, see kind of a thumbnail of the image. Now, to turn this on, you need to quit Finder using the Activity Monitor or Terminal or any other way, then open the terminal and enter a command, which I'll put into the show notes. I actually tried it with a folder of photos, and as I say, you can just about see each image, but it is behind the folder icon, so I don't think it's really usable.
No, I had a look at it on your machine rather than fiddle with my own, but it's more of a gimmick, isn't it, than something useful.
It is, yeah. And also, as long as you've turned that command on in through the terminal, you also get the effect in the preview section. So when you right click and you go to get info and you look at that preview section, you see you get the same effect. But I take your point. It is too small to actually be that useful.
I had a problem as well with my preview, and this happened in everywhere that you would preview a file. So either in the Command and I info window, the little thumbnail at the bottom, or Quick Look, or the Finder view, you know, the cover flow view in Finder. And what was happening was, instead of seeing the whole of my image, I was seeing just a tiny square out of the middle of my image. Now, it was something that had been on the machine since it was new, and I don't think I'd ever reinstalled Leopard on it. So it got to the point where I thought, oh, Snow Leopard's coming out soon, so I'll wait and see what happens. Anyway, it seems to have fixed itself now. It was just obviously just one of those quirks, but I don't generally tinker around with it because I've seen what happens when it breaks. And it was incredibly annoying because all I'd get, my images off my digital SLR were so big that a 1-inch square piece out of the middle of it could be somebody's jumper, and I would be none the wiser what the image looked like. And again, we've said how easy it is to get reliant on Quick Look. And when it stops working, it is a major pain.
It is, yeah. whilst I was reading through the thread about the X-ray on the website macOS10hints.com, it actually mentioned in this thread that this X-ray works for zip files, but I couldn't actually get that working. However, there was a link to a free app called BetterZip Quick Look Plugin. Now, I know we were talking the other week about getting Quick Look working on zip files. And
yeah, I was sure it worked with Stuffit Expander because I did not have anything else installed, but it's not working for me now.
No,
not even the new version is working for me. So this sounds good.
Yeah, what I did, you download it, it's free. Download it, unzip it, and copy the file that gets unzipped to your Quick Look folder inside your library in your home folder. You might actually have to create a Quick Look folder, I did. Then what you need to do is just wait a few minutes for the system to update and run a Quick Look on a zip file, and then it will display in the Quick Look window what's in the zip file. So folder structure, file name, date, size of each file, type of each file, and it will even give you the attributes.
Brilliant. I've actually extended my Quick Look as well to handle other files. I have an application called Sneak Peek Pro, and it gives me previews of all my Adobe file types. And not just, mainly I find that useful for InDesign and Illustrator files, but it doesn't just give you a quick preview of the contents of the file. It also gives you information about the file size, the fonts used, the swatches. So it's really useful. Now, there's also a new plugin for Quick Look, which will give you more information about JPEGs as well. So I think that's something that we should have a look at as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And another Snow Leopard annoyance got fixed recently too. Funny thing was, you hadn't even noticed it was broken, had you?
No, that dictionary thing you were going on about.
Going on about. It was broken. Yes, on Tiger and Leopard, the dictionary application that's built in, it used to reuse the window. So you would open the dictionary, type in your word. You could use the dictionary thesaurus. I think it even searches the web as well and Wikipedia. And I navigate the whole thing with keyboard shortcuts, so I never actually click anywhere in it. The whole thing is really, really good with shortcuts. So when I finished with it, I command and Q and it closes it down. And on Tiger and Leopard, it was fine. On Snow Leopard, what was happening was I'd open up the dictionary, I'd use it, and I'd use command and Q to quit it. But when it reopened, I activate it with launch bar again. So I actually pass to it the word I'm querying via launch bar. So when it opens, instead of opening with a single window, it opens with a window with the word that you are currently querying. And behind that, there is the window that you last had open. So I'd noticed this thinking, oh, it didn't do that before. So I close the window and then close the other window and thought, strange. Anyway, it kept doing it, so obviously it's a feature. Cheers for that one. What I found was, if I used Command and W, which is the shortcut key to close a window, and it happened to be the last window that was open in the dictionary app, it would actually quit the app as well, which meant that when I reopened it, it was fine, so it worked the old way. But you wouldn't believe how quickly you get used to its Command and Q to quit. So what I was having to try and remember was that for every other application, it's command and Q to quit it. But for the dictionary app, make sure you command and W. And then what I was finding was I was command and W-ing it to close the window and then trying to command and quit it. And of course, if I did that, it quit the application that it had flicked back to. So it was really annoying.
Yeah, that would be annoying, wouldn't it?
Well, there's a fix. That usual terminal hack, but it's simple enough to implement. We'll add the actual code to the show notes. My only gripe with it is, I think the dictionary app now takes longer to open than it did before. But I suppose that could be my imagination because I'm usually in a rush. But if you don't fancy the terminal hack, then what you can do is Command and W to close it and not Command and Q. Now, it doesn't sound like much to remember, you know, just use one shortcut instead of another. But trying to change the shortcut keys that you're used to is a nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah, don't I know it. I was railroaded into changing something that I've only just learnt this week in terms of keyboard shortcuts.
I know, and apologies for that, but it was needed, and you will thank me in the long run. I need to explain this, don't I?
Yeah.
Don't sulk. Yes, it was all to do with screen sharing and the way that screen sharing key maps in Snow Leopard. There have been much improvements to it. For example, you can now use the default shortcut keys to take screenshots. And what was happening before in Leopard and Tiger was when you were sharing a screen and you used those shortcut keys, it took screenshots of the machine that you were actually on and not the remote machine. But now those shortcut keys work remotely, which is great when I'm doing system admin stuff and I'm trying to take a shot of the screen to make sure, you know, check what I've done later. So Command and Shift and 3. And Command and Shift and 4, which respectively take a screenshot of the whole screen or an area of it. And also Command Option Shift 3 and Command Option Shift 4, which does exactly the same, but instead of creating a file, it copies it to your clipboard. They also work as well. But not all shortcut keys are passed to the remote machine. Now, what we'd done was I'd left Command and Spacebar alone, so that carried on as a default machine and it would activate Spotlight. What I'd done for Launch Bar was use Control and Space, but what was happening was that didn't translate, so it wouldn't send Control and Space to the remote machine. What I did on the machines I mainly use remotely was map instead of Control and Space to Launch Bar, I used Control and L. But then I needed to remember two shortcut keys, and it didn't work on Mike's anyway, because he'd also mapped his to Control and Spacebar. So I'd actually have to access Launch Bar using the mouse, which was even worse. So the good news is that under Snow Leopard, Command and Spacebar does get sent to the remote machine. But obviously that was set up to access Spotlight. So I needed a way to have Command and Space activate Launch Bar and still be able to access Spotlight. So what I managed to do was map Command and Spacebar inside Launch Bar to activate Launch Bar. And if I need to access Spotlight, then I use Option Command and Spacebar, which I have set up in Launch Bar. So really it's a case of going to the machine preferences and turning off all the access keys for Spotlight and setting the whole thing up in Launch Bar for me. It was painful for a few days, but now at least all the machines work in the same way, whether you're on them remotely or locally.
Yeah, it was painful, but I have got used to it now. And I've not forgiven you yet, but ScreenFlow paid you back, didn't it, on my behalf?
Oh, yes, ScreenFlow. Now, I love ScreenFlow. I really do love it. It's a fantastic piece of software, but it's one of those activated pieces of software, which I don't like at all. So as I've said previously, I always think very, very carefully about buying a piece of software that's activated, because I'm always mindful of what will happen if a machine dies and I can't deactivate it. Or worse still, I have a machine sat there ready and a software key ready to put in and it won't activate. And that's exactly what happened. I deactivated my ScreenFlow on the machines I had it installed on. And I had a clean install. I thought, right, I need to activate this. So I put the key in and it won't have it. It did contact the server, or it seemed to. So it tried to contact the activation server and it wouldn't have it. And it wasn't giving me any kind of meaningful message either. That would have been too much to ask, wouldn't it? So the message I was getting was something about a -2003 error or something, which didn't mean a thing to me. Now, obviously, before I start screaming at support, I Google it to see if other people have got the problem. And yes, I wasn't on my own. There was at least one other person, and it was in the ScreenFlow forums. And what had happened with them was, I think they must have at some point had this software activated, and the activation had then stopped working. So somebody from ScreenFlow sent them a little application. They ran the application and it worked. It cured the problem. So I thought, OK, just need to get on to support. So, of course, I vented my spleen on Twitter before I got on to support. And then I got on to support and I got a message back saying, we will endeavour to contact you regarding, you know, the ticket you've raised within 24 hours. I thought, 24 hours, subject to time zone changes, of course, as well. Not really good enough when I'm sat there with a piece of software I've paid for and I can't activate. Luckily, their Twitter presence was far more on the ball, and I got a message back asking me to DM them. So I did, and they did attempt to help me. I pointed them to the information on their own forums, and pretty much the upshot of it was they couldn't help me. The difference was why it was working for some people and not me was the solution that they had in terms of they sent you this little application, you ran it and it cured the problem, only worked if the software was already activated. And obviously, if the software was already activated, I wouldn't have been screaming about the fact that it wouldn't activate. So apart from that, they had no clue. Now, that was on Twitter. In the meanwhile, I hear back from the support on email, who very kindly sent me a 2-page eulogy about how to install a serial number in a piece of software. Stop tittering. Yes, I wasn't impressed with that at all. It literally told me, you know, press here, press there. This dialogue box will come up, paste your serial number in and you're done. If you've still got problems, you know, get back to us. I thought, I won't tell you what I thought. It wouldn't translate well. So, not impressed with that at all. In the meanwhile, going backwards and forwards, and I'm thinking, well, they've known about this problem for a month, and they've clearly not done anything about it for a month, because what they were saying was they would need to release a point version to solve the problem. And in a month, they had not done that, so I wasn't impressed with that either. So I'm still trying at this point. They've checked my serial numbers and said, yes, I've got 2 serial numbers, and they've said that they're both fine, just that they won't activate, and they have no clue why. So I have a look at the application they've sent me, and I thought, well, you're on your own here, which I don't find acceptable. There's nothing else that they could, that the people themselves could actually do. Obviously, the developers could develop the thing in a different way, and you could take the activation out of it. That would be nice. But failing that, no, if it won't activate, it won't activate, and there's nothing that they could do. So I was left on my own devices, so I started hacking around. And luckily, I found a solution, obviously. Necessity, mother of invention. And what I found was the instructions they'd given me told me to delete the contents of some folders. So I dutifully went off and I did all that. And when I tried with the little application, it still didn't work. But I noticed that one of the folders that they were talking about, it didn't exist anyway. So there was nothing to delete because the folder wasn't there. As that didn't work, I then thought, right, I think I potentially see a problem here. Maybe the software on Snow Leopard, in my case, it doesn't have the right to create a folder in that location. Now, I was installing under an admin account, and it was the first account on the machine, so it's a super admin account. So there was no reason that the account was causing a problem, and I'd repaired permissions, and I'd rebooted, and I'd done all of that several times. Didn't make a difference. So what I did was I created a folder in the location that they told me that I should delete the contents of the folder. So I created this folder. Then I went through the process again and it worked. So I typed it all up for them and I sent it back to them. Obviously, other people must have that problem. I did do a search on the error and like I said, I wasn't the only one. If they had already activated it, then this half a solution would work. If they had not activated it, that would not work. And they did not have a cure for it. So I sent it back. And on Twitter, I did get a little note back from them. Just seen your solution. Brilliant. So I did get a brilliant for it. But this is why I don't like activated software. I should not have to do that. And just because I can do it doesn't mean everybody else can do it. So if anybody's having problems with that, let me know. And I know I should type it up for a blog post, but I'm incredibly busy at the minute. But I will try and get round to doing that. And roll on ScreenFlow 2. And I did mention that I hoped it wouldn't happen in ScreenFlow 2. So there you go. There was the best part of, I think that took 7 hours in total. By the time I'd fixed it, I'd forgotten what I wanted to record. So I called it a night then.
Ridiculous, really, isn't it?
I know that's activated software, but I mean, this is what on Twitter people coming back to me and saying, you know, wouldn't happen if you got a crack from somewhere. And they're quite right. And was I tempted? Well, I was desperate to get the software working. And it's criminal. I actually legally own it and I can't actually use it. But as people were saying, well, I'm sure all the people out there with cracks, they're fine. Theirs is working fine. So that didn't give me any comfort at all. But what can you say? I don't like activated software to start with, and I think I have 3, possibly 4 pieces of software that are activated, and that's it. And it does put me off buying. Not because I'm trying to put it on 27 machines. I'd just like it on the one I want it on, working, you know, if I don't have an internet connection. The last time I had problems with this, I was trying to deactivate. And my internet connection was that bad, I couldn't deactivate, which meant I couldn't do a reinstall. So they don't think about these things. They really don't. But in better news, we don't have a software review, we have a hardware review. And this week we have new toys, new hardware toys at Matchbikes HQ. We have a power monkey, or as Mike calls it,
a monkey charger.
Yes, hopefully you're not trying to charge monkeys with it. So what does it look like? Well, what is it and what does it look like? Should we do the what it looks like first?
Mm.
Yes, it's quite difficult to explain. It's Do you remember the Toys of an Adult Nature?
I do.
It sort of looks like one of those, and I opted for black. Let's say all it needs is a Max Bikes thong to use as a case, and it'd be perfect.
Don't go there.
No, better not. No, better not. Oh, what a mental image. Poor Minster's just brought his lunch back, you know. Anyway, it is said Power Monkey is a portable power unit. So what you do with it is you can charge it from the mains or you can charge it via USB. So if you actually need to charge the power unit, you can do that on the road from your laptop, which is quite cool. I did it on the mains and it was pretty quick. And what you then do with it is you carry it around with you and it holds sufficient of a charge to be able to recharge your iPhone or your iPod 4 times while you're out on the road before it itself needs recharging. It's not just limited to iPhones or iPods either. It comes with, in the box with this said device, a whole range of other adapters. Stop sniggering again. Yeah, so it can work with Sony, Ericsson, Nokia, all sorts of other things. It's even got a very tiny USB connector. So you can charge a range of devices with it. I opted for that one rather than some of the others that are dedicated to the iPhone or iPod, just for the flexibility of it. Maybe, you know, maybe I would need to charge my cheapy other mobile phone that I have. So it would charge that as well. It works great. It charged from flat in about 4 hours and it charges the device pretty quickly too. I haven't actually timed that though. So it was great for me with my battery running down all the time due to my growls on the prowl. Now, it's not as integrated as the Morphe Juice Pack, but then it doesn't add bulk to the phone when you're not using it. So you really only use it for charging on the road. Good thing with it is that once you plug it in, if you're reaching the point of no return with your phone, as soon as you plug it in, it's just the same as plugging the phone into your computer or into a wall socket. So you can immediately start using it while it's charging. So, and the other thing is, I thought it was very cost effective. Morphe Juice Pack is quite expensive given the price of the phone. And this device is only £35, which includes the VAT and the postage. And the postage was very fast. I think it took 2 days. So I can highly recommend that. As I say, I got it really just so because my phone does tend to run down. Possibly I use it a little bit too much. And I did turn my growls on the prowl off and the battery life increased immensely. Some days I didn't charge it for 3 days. But once I put my growls on the prowl back, it started dying rather quickly again. So very, very handy to have with you. Doesn't take up that much room. And if you can charge it 4 times as well, you're not constantly charging up the device as well. So a Power Monkey. We'll put a link to their site. I think I got mine from the manufacturer. And I thought it was a very high quality device as well. Ships in a nice box and it feels nice. So not cheap and nasty. Do not stick. You're sniggering.
I'm just thinking about monkey charges.
No, you're just thinking it feels nice, but get over it. Right. So I can highly recommend that. And I know you want one now, don't you?
I do.
Have you got some monkeys to charge?
Anyway, we couldn't let the week go by without a quick mention for Busy Cal. Version 1's now been released, so congratulations to the guys at Busy Mac. And don't forget, you can get 20% off the total of your bill if you go and buy a copy or multiple copies by using the MacBytes coupon code when you purchase via their website.
Yep, we did say that that was only good to the end of September, but they've extended it for us for a little bit. So if you missed out and you thought you'd missed out, go to busycal.com and try using the coupon code and save some money. Anyway, feedback and comments. We have actually had lots of feedback over the last 2 weeks, mainly asking where we were. So it was good to know that we were missed. So thank you for all the messages, all the posts, all the tweets. We are most grateful to hear from you. It's been great to hear from you guys. But sadly, that is it for this episode of MacBytes. We would love to hear from you now we're back, so tell us what you think. So send your questions, comments, queries to macbytesuk@gmail.com or send us an audio file. And you can also contact us on the contact form on the website at macbytes.co.uk. You can also follow us on Twitter. So twitter.com/MacBytes. You can follow me personally on Twitter at twitter.com/ElaineGiles.
And you can follow me at twitter.com/ThomasMike.
But until next time, this has been Elaine and Mike bringing you MacBytes. Goodbye and see you next time.
Goodbye.